This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
On this April the 22nd, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. And here are some of your Thursday headlines. It is Earth Day, with some major initiatives announced by the White House. We'll have details just ahead. The House of Representatives passing a party-line vote to make D.C. the 51st state, but it's facing an uncertain political future in the U.S. Senate. The CDC says more than 50% of American adults have received at least one COVID-19 vaccine, at an average rate of now 3 million doses being administered every day. That, though, is down slightly from a week ago. And a new Quinnipiac University poll found that 27% of Americans do not plan to get vaccinated. The U.S. jobless rate fell by 547,000. That is a new pandemic low. And Republicans offering a counterproposal to President Biden's multi-trillion dollar infrastructure plan. Just some of the stories shaping Washington Today. All ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin at the White House, where President Biden kicked off a two-day virtual summit with a single agenda item, climate change. The president vowing to cut U.S. emissions of greenhouse gases in half from the 2005 levels by the year 2030. That, of course, is 9 years from now. He also announced plans to double U.S. financial assistance by the year 2024 for developing countries. From the reporting of the New York Times, there is this, quote, "The two-day summit comes at a time when scientists are warning that governments must take decisive action to prevent global temperatures from rising more than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. The consequences," writes the New York Times, "of exceeding that threshold include mass species extinctions, water shortages, and extreme weather events that will be most devastating to the poorest countries least responsible for causing global warming." Now, officially, nations that are party to the Paris Agreement are obligated to announce their new targets for those emission cuts in time for the UN conference in Scotland that takes place in November. More details at nytimes.com. Here's President Biden.
I see the engineers and the construction workers building new carbon capture and green hydrogen plants to forge cleaner steel and cement and produce clean power. I see farmers deploying cutting-edge tools to make soil of our heartland the next frontier in carbon innovation. By maintaining those investments and putting these people to work, the United States sets out on the road to cut greenhouse gases in half by the end of this decade. That's where we're headed as a nation. And that's what we can do if we take action to build an economy that's not only more prosperous, but healthier, fairer, and cleaner for the entire planet. You know, these steps will set America on a path of net zero emissions economy by no later than 2050.
Held virtually, today's summit, by the way, the first of its kind convened by a U.S. president, other world leaders, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel, the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Another promise from another world leader, China's President Xi Jinping, who said that his country would strictly limit increasing coal consumption in the next 5 years and phase it down in the following 5 years. Now, that's significant because China is the world's largest coal consumer. But here in this country, Republican skeptics on the price tag, including this reaction from South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham.
Speaking for myself, I believe climate change is real. I believe the Green New Deal is a terrible deal for the United States. You can't really solve the problem unless India and China are involved. I'll be glad to look at it. I'll be glad to work with President Biden on infrastructure. I'll be glad to have a healthy conversation about climate change. I'll be glad to find common ground where I can, but I am going to echo what Senator Cruz said. Mr. President, there's some real big assaults on democracy and democratic institutions occurring on your watch and your AWOL. You said it was a bonehead idea for FDR to try to pack the court. You're sitting on the sidelines while your president forming a commission that may actually do that. The Joe Biden that was progressive but reasonable needs to emerge, because it's pretty hard for me to sit down and try to find a way to solve problems when your party is trying to destroy the country as I know it. So I would just ask that President Biden have a timeout on some of these radical ideas so that we can find some common ground.
That from Senator Lindsey Graham responding to a question on the issue of climate change and the Green New Deal. He was outside the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll have more on that story and Republican complaints of court packing later in the program. Meanwhile, the White House says the billions required to cut greenhouse emissions is the only way to put the U.S. on a path that would eliminate fossil fuel pollution by the middle of this century. On the same day that the president was talking to world leaders, a House subcommittee held a hearing on the climate issue as well. Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, now 18 years old, warning lawmakers that history will hold them accountable for what she calls climate catastrophes if they do not stop subsidizing fossil fuel production. She called tax breaks for that industry a disgrace. More from the hearing.
We have to end fossil fuel subsidies. Stop new exploration and extraction, completely divest from fossil fuels, and keep the carbon in the ground. Now, especially the US, taking into account the fact that it is the biggest emitter in history. And just to be clear, that is not my opinion. It is what the science clearly shows. And yet, this is just the very minimum amount of effort that is needed to start the rapid sustainable transition. And it may seem like we are asking for a lot. And you will, of course, say that we are naive. And that's fine. But at least we are not so naive that we believe things will be solved through countries and companies making vague, distant, insufficient targets without any real pressure from the media and the general public. So either you do this, or you're going to have to start explain to your children and the most affected people why you are surrendering on the 1.5 degree target, giving up without even trying. Well, what I'm here to say is that unlike you, my generation will not give up without a fight. And to be honest, I don't believe for a second that you will actually do this. The climate crisis doesn't exist in the public debate today. And since it doesn't really exist, and the general level of awareness is so absurdly low, you will still get away with continuing to contribute to the destruction of present and future living conditions. And I know I'm not the one who's supposed to ask questions here, but there is something I really do wonder. How long do you honestly believe that people in power like you will get away with it? How long do you think you can continue to ignore the climate crisis, the global aspect of equity and historic emissions, without being held accountable? You get away with it now, but sooner or later, people are going to realize what you have been doing all this time. That's inevitable. You still have time to do the right thing and to save your legacies. But that window of time is not going to last for long.
That's from Greta Thunberg. She is a Swedish political activist. As we said, she's 18 years old before a House subcommittee. Also today, the president's climate envoy, former Secretary of State John Kerry, saying President Trump's policies on the issue, quote, destroyed America's credibility. But on the Senate floor, more criticism of the White House plan, the price tag of the Green New Deal. Here is Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell.
Madam President, yesterday I mentioned that the DNA of the far-left Green New Deal is all over President Biden's spending bills. It wasn't just my opinion. It was the verdict of our colleague, the junior senator from Massachusetts. Today, the president is scheduled to meet virtually with a group of the world's leaders on climate policy. His agenda reportedly is to encourage them to expand their country's Paris Climate Agreement commitments to meet even more ambitious emissions goals. The problem, of course, as our colleagues no doubt remember, is that the hollow commitments these countries made back in 2015 carry no serious means for enforcement. Under the last administration, even from outside this agreement, the U.S. economy proved more than capable of meaningfully reducing CO2 emissions. But many of the signatories within the supposed deal have largely ignored their stated commitments and continue to emit with reckless abandon. As the Biden administration climate envoy, John Kerry, once lamented, quote, "Most countries are not getting the job done in living up to Paris," end quote. China, for example, has just kept emitting more and done it shamelessly. Their share of greenhouse gas emissions is now nearly double that of the United States.
Read that from Republican leader Mitch McConnell. Of course, we carry the Senate live every day that they are in session on C-SPAN 2. Some history. The first Earth Day was 51 years ago, April 22, 1970. That same year, President Richard Nixon formed the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. And in 1972, he told Congress the following.
"Each of us all across this great land has a stake in maintaining and improving environmental quality. Clean air and clean water, the wise use of our land, the protection of wildlife and natural beauty, parks for all to enjoy. These are part of the birthright of every American. To guarantee that birthright, we must act, and act decisively. It is literally now or never."
President Richard Nixon in 1972, and for another perspective on the issue of climate change, we're joined on the phone from Bozeman, Montana, Terry Anderson. He serves as a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and is out with a new book, Adapt and Be Adept. In the book, you write the following, quote, "Market forces are causing human beings to adapt to climate change." So to that point, could you explain?
Well, let me start with an explanation of the climate change part. To the extent that climate is changing, then the question is, what do people do about it? And most people have said, well, let's throw trillions of dollars at it to stop it from happening. And that's just not going to work in the foreseeable future, which is one of the reasons for pushback on Biden's trillions of dollars. I think the scientists who study climate change, and I'm very careful to say I'm not one of them, and I just take the science as I read it. I think the scientists are quite clear that even if we do everything in the Paris Accord by 2100, we will see a minuscule reduction in the amount of temperature increase that's been predicted. So climate change is there. The question is not can we stop it, which, and I think the answer to that is not in any foreseeable future. What should we do? And lots of people say, well, we need to be resilient. And there's certainly good evidence of that. And the richer we are, the more resilient we are. But more importantly, and the point of the quote you read, is that when individuals are faced with prices that indicate what climate change is doing, they react. Example, property values in Dade County in Miami on the beach are falling relative to higher ground. That's telling people you don't want to own places where there's storm surge and hurricanes. Get up to high ground. And the result is people are building less in those places. Another example, if farmers are facing less water, they start searching for ways to grow their crops with the less water or find different crops or move where they grow crops. These are all ways people are adapting in response to, with market forces inducing them to respond to climate change.
But does that adaptation need to be universal, worldwide, in order to make a difference?
Well, I think it needs to be worldwide if by make a difference we mean getting people to take what's on the table, climate change, and make adjustments to live by it. I mean, human beings, since we climbed out of trees, have been adapting to all kinds of climate changes. And it's the human ingenuity, the human nature in finding ways to adapt that has made us survive for the millennia. and it's what will work in the future. And that applies just as much in Africa as it does in Miami or the United States. So, you know, what people need to do is have two things. One, information that gives them an incentive to adapt. For example, don't subsidize hurricane insurance or fire insurance, or people will not adapt. And two, must have the wherewithal to adapt, and that means having economic growth. All the proposals that are presented, if followed through on, will reduce economic growth. Sure, for you and me, that'll make some difference, but for the people who are already poor, it will make even more difference, giving them less ability to adapt.
Going back to your book, Adapt and Be Adept, the globe is warming, ice caps are melting, sea levels are creeping up. And based on what you just said a moment ago, what is the short and long-term solution? How best can we deal with this beyond some of the measures that you have just outlined?
The short-term solutions are pretty much totally individualistic. That is, my wife and I have a little bit of land behind us, to our house, 15 acres, and we've thinned the trees there because we want to be prepared for the potential of wildfire, whether that's caused by climate change or whatever. We want to be prepared. So largely it's individualistic. Fruit farmers in Michigan are moving their orchards north because there's better weather and better production north. Wine production, that's really important, is also migrating as a result of this. So those are the short-term individualistics. Related to that, and this brings us to a longer term, is making sure we give people the information they need to adapt. You know, getting good data, and the government has a responsibility here, on what's happening, storm surge, hurricanes, drought, snowfall, you name it, is really useful for individual responses. And secondly, getting the government, stopping the government from subsidizing bad behavior. Crop insurance in the United States is a horrible program which encourages people to continue to plant the way they did yesterday and not worry about the consequences of climate change, which could mean disasters for crops. And so we subsidize them to stay where they are and keep doing what they are. So getting those kinds of bad signals out and providing good signals is the key to adaptation.
The subtitle of the book, Market Responses to Climate Change, Terry Anderson. He is joining us from Bozeman, Montana, also serves as a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution on the campus of Stanford University. We thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Also here in Washington today, the House passing a bill that would make Washington, D.C. the 51st state. It was a party line vote, 216 to 208, sending the legislation now to the higher chamber, the U.S. Senate. Today's vote was the second in a year to make D.C. to be called Washington, Douglas Commonwealth. It would be composed of most of D.C.'s current territory, but there would be a federal district around the White House and part of the National Mall, as well as the Capitol. Now, Washington is home to more than 710,000 residents. That, by the way, is more than the number of residents in two other states, Vermont and Wyoming. Today's debate on the House floor often becoming heated. Here is New York Democrat Mondaire Jones.
Mr. Speaker, I have had enough of my colleagues' racist insinuations that somehow the people of Washington, D.C. are incapable or even unworthy of our democracy. One Senate Republican said that D.C. wouldn't be a, quote, well-rounded working-class state. I had no idea there were so many syllables in the word white. One of my House Republican colleagues said that D.C. shouldn't be a state because the district doesn't have a landfill. My goodness, with all the racist trash my colleagues have brought to this debate, I can see why they're worried about having a place to put it. The truth is, there is no good faith argument for disenfranchising over 700,000 people, Mr. Speaker, most of whom are people of color.
Probably wouldn't pass.
What's that?
Probably wouldn't pass.
The gentleman's time was not timely.
Mr. Speaker, point of order.
Was not timely. The gentleman from New York will proceed.
The rules say make the point of order when the words need to be taken. He has to be recognized, Mr. Speaker. We understand parliamentary procedure.
The debate has proceeded and the ban was not timely. Gentleman from New York is recognized.
The truth is, there is no good faith argument for disenfranchising.
Consent to withdraw his words.
Does the gentleman from New York ask for unanimous consent to withdraw the words?
Mr. Speaker, that's fine. You have my consent to withdraw.
Gentleman withdraws his words. Debate is going to continue. Gentleman from New York is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The truth is, there is no good faith argument for disenfranchising over 700,000 people, most of whom are people of color. These desperate objections are about fear. Fear that in D.C. their white supremacist politics will no longer play. Fear that soon enough white supremacist politics won't work anywhere in America. Fear that if they don't rig our democracy, they will not win. Today, Democrats are standing up for a multiracial democracy to democratize all 51 states in this country. I yield back.
And that's how it unfolded. Congressman Jones of New York, you heard in the background Louie Gohmert, Republican of Texas, and the acting speaker at the chair. We carry the House live on C-SPAN television. The federal enclave would not be part of any future state in D.C. That would include the area from Capitol Hill to the White House, as well as the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, and some of the Smithsonian museums. But in the debate, Republicans called for what they called retrosecession, essentially making D.C. part of Maryland again. Here is Kentucky Congressman James Comer.
H.R. 51 is not really about voting representation. It's about Democrats consolidating their power in Washington. There are numerous problems with H.R. 51. Mainly, it's flatly unconstitutional. Every Justice Department, from President Kennedy's to President Obama's, has been consistent that a constitutional amendment is needed to grant the district statehood. Robert F. Kennedy said granting D.C. statehood without a constitutional amendment was inconceivable. He also said granting D.C. statehood as attempted by H.R. 51 would produce an absurdity. This absurdity is the 23rd Amendment, which acknowledges the existence of a federal district warranting 3 electoral college votes. While H.R. 51 includes an expedited process for the 23rd Amendment's repeal in Congress, the problem is this would not happen until after D.C. becomes a state. This would create mass confusion as H.R. 51 is reviewed by the courts for years. The Constitution is the foundational document upon which all the laws of our country rest, and Congress cannot simply dismiss it with sham legislation. But that's what H.R. 51 attempts to do.
The Kentucky Republican joining his GOP lawmakers in opposing the bill. Again, the final vote in the House today, 216 to 208. It again now heads to the U.S. Senate, where it faces a far different political environment. We'll have more on that just ahead. But first, Democratic leader Chuck Schumer.
I applaud my House Democratic colleagues for taking this important step towards recognizing the full citizenship of more than 700,000 residents of the District of Columbia. This is a matter of just representation. Our system of government is designed to give everyone in our country a voice in forging their own destiny. Most citizens do that by voting for members of Congress and senators from their states to represent them in this temple of democracy, to advocate for their interests, to voice their concerns. The District of Columbia has more residents than Vermont and Wyoming, and nearly the same as Delaware, Alaska, and several other states. And they bear the full responsibilities and duties of citizenship, like residents in all those other states. D.C. residents can be summoned for jury duty. They have served in every war since the American Revolution, and they pay federal income taxes just like residents from every other state. You can learn from any license plate outside. You can learn that from any license plate outside this building. And yet, they are denied real representation in Congress. In the words D.C. borrowed from the Founding Fathers, taxation without representation. Sadly, the debate over D.C. statehood has taken a rather dark turn. Some of my colleagues on the other side rather than fashion any argument on the merits, have taken to denigrating the basic worth of residents of the District of Columbia.
That from the Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer of New York, and joining us on the phone is Zach Smith. He is a legal fellow at the Mies Center, part of the Heritage Foundation here in Washington, D.C. First of all, is this even constitutional?
Well, I certainly don't think so. And more importantly, both Republican and Democratic justice departments that have looked at this issue historically have said that the District of Columbia becoming a state by simple legislation is unconstitutional, that a constitutional amendment would be needed to transform the status of the district from a federal enclave into our nation's 51st state.
You have been following the debate today and really the last couple of months. What challenges does this face first in the U.S. Senate and then potentially in the courts?
Sure. Well, it certainly looks like it faces a more uphill battle in the Senate. Obviously, it passed along a strictly party line vote in the House of Representatives today. So far, four Democratic senators or three Democratic senators and one who caucuses with the Democrats have said they are not co-sponsoring the bill as of right now. That's Mark Kelly and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, and then Angus King of Maine have not come on board with the bill yet. So obviously, without their support, it cannot pass. And more importantly, you know, one of the issues that's tied in with this bill is the filibuster. And so I'm hopeful that Senator Manchin's, Senator Sinema's promise not to destroy the filibuster will hold and that they won't be tempted to create a carve out or anything like that for the issue of D.C. statehood, especially given the constitutional concerns surrounding this bill.
But how do you address the issue for those citizens who live in Washington, D.C., who continue to complain taxation without representation?
Well, look, I don't think anyone, whether you support or oppose D.C. statehood, would disagree with the fact that the founding fathers intended for the district to be a separate federal entity and that they intended for it to be represented by Congress as a whole. And so the real question is whether you think that's valid, whether you think it has become invalid, is how do you convert the status of the District of Columbia? And once again, the way that you would change this, that you would correct this, if you think it's a problem, is through a constitutional amendment, not by a simple legislative act of Congress.
Is there room for compromise, or is this merely a political issue?
Well, it certainly seems like it's very caught up in politics right now. Admitting new states has always involved careful political calculations. But certainly, we've heard a lot of accusations that those who are opposed to D.C. statehood are opposed based on political grounds. But the same is true. Those who are pushing it right now in this manner certainly seem to be pushing forward for political purposes and the hope of gaining two solidly Democratic senators in the U.S. Senate.
The work of Zach Smith, it's available online at heritage.org, where he serves as a legal fellow. Thank you for your time.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow losing 321 points. The NASDAQ was off by nearly 132, and the S&P down 38.5. One key reason for today's big drop, a Bloomberg story that President Biden is considering a capital gains tax for wealthy Americans. Right now, the tax rate is at 20%, but according to Bloomberg News, the potential Biden plan may nearly double that to 39.6%. You're listening to Washington Today.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
And welcome back. This is Washington Today for this Thursday, a program also available as a podcast. Here are some of your other headlines. President Biden delivering a speech before a joint session of Congress next week. We learned today the Republican response Wednesday night will come from South Carolina Senator Tim Scott. We, of course, will have live coverage of the speeches here on C-SPAN Radio, live on C-SPAN Television. And a follow-up on a story that we brought up yesterday here on the program, Russia's defense minister saying earlier today that massive military exercise near the border with Ukraine has been completed. He said he's ordered troops to return to their permanent bases by May the 1st. Tens of thousands of troops, as well as heavy equipment, had been moved to the border of eastern Ukraine, as well as the annexed territory of Crimea over the last month, sparking fears of a potential Russian invasion. Here in Washington, the Senate passing legislation today targeting anti-Asian hate crimes after an uptick of incidents since the start of this COVID-19 pandemic. Lawmakers approving the measure, the final vote, 94-1. Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, the only member to oppose the legislation. The chief sponsor, Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono. It would, among other things, direct the Department of Justice to expedite the review of hate crimes related to COVID-19 that were reported to law enforcement agencies, as well as help them establish ways to report such incidents online and perform public outreach. More details from the Senate floor.
Mr. President, as the author of this bill, I totally disagree with characterizing this bill as a bitter partisan beginning, as having a bitter partisan beginning. But my colleague is exercising his free speech rights, so there you go. Mr. President, after 2 weeks of hard work and bipartisan collaboration, the United States Senate is poised to take real action to confront the wave of anti-Asian hate sweeping our country. Although we still have some damaging amendments to defeat, I am confident that in a few hours, the Senate will pass the COVID-19 Hate Crimes Act as amended with the substitute Hirono Collins Amendment. By doing so, we will send a powerful message of solidarity to the AAPI community that the Senate will not be a bystander as anti-Asian violence surges in our country. Over the past years, hate crimes targeting AAPI has risen 150%, as noted. More than 3,800 incidents have been reported across all 50 states and the District of Columbia. These statistics paint a disturbing picture of what's happening in our country, but they only quantify part of the problem. Why? Because hate crimes and other incidents are notoriously underrepresented. These attacks have not ceased in the 2 weeks since the Senate began debating this bill.
And by the way, a similar bill focusing on anti-Asian hate crimes making its way through the House. Those comments earlier today by Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono. The Senate vote today was 94-1. Meanwhile, the White House is evaluating a $568 billion Republican counterproposal to President Biden's $2.25 trillion infrastructure package, with administration officials calling it a potential starting point for negotiations. Republicans saying that their bill focuses on infrastructure, while the president's plan does include funds to invest in child care, as well as the elderly, and money to promote the production and purchase of electric vehicles. West Virginia Senator Shelley Moore Capito joining her GOP colleagues at a Capitol Hill news conference.
This is a robust package when we look at where we're focusing our infrastructure needs. The funding levels and the principles are meant to guide us. And then we would say, and I would say, now's the time for the committees to get to work. And that's why I think it's really important to note that the folks that are here with me today, Senator Crapo can't join, are the ranking members of the relevant committees that would be moving forward a robust infrastructure package. I've done a lot of outreach to my fellow Republicans. I've talked to Democrats, I've talked to my committee chair, Senator Carper, more than a few times, and I've talked with the White House, which many of us have. Some of us have been down to the White House to talk directly with the president, but we've certainly been talking about how important this is for a 21st century that has forward-looking, innovative infrastructure. So we agree that these bills are necessary and that the committees of jurisdiction should be the ones that force the compromise and forge the great policies that we need to make sure that we're meeting this challenge.
That from Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia. Here are some of the numbers. The package calling for nearly $300 billion for roads and bridges, $65 billion for broadband infrastructure, $61 billion for public transit systems, $35 billion for drinking water and wastewater treatment, $44 billion for airports, $20 billion for rail systems, $17 billion for ports and inland waterways, $14 billion for water storage, and another $13 billion for what they are calling safety purposes. And a group of Republican senators speaking in front of the U.S. Supreme Court on a different topic, opposing the idea of court packing, a response to legislation by Democrats introduced earlier this month. The press conference that took place, we heard earlier from Senator Lindsey Graham, who joined Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee and Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. Collectively, they say the idea of court packing is an effort to, quote, rig the Supreme Court, and they pleaded with President Biden to buck what they call the crazies in his party. Here's Senator Cruz.
What Senate Democrats and House Democrats are trying to do is fundamentally corrupt. Their first priority is to change the rules to stay in power. Now, that tells you a lot of things. It tells you, number one, they don't believe in democracy. They don't believe in the voters. If they want to stay in power, there's a real simple path to that. Convince the voters your ideas are right. But that's too complicated. Sometimes the voters disagree. So what are Senate Democrats trying to do? They're trying to add new senators to the Senate so they keep control forever. They're trying to change voting in America so Democrats can never lose. And they want to pack the U.S. Supreme Court with four left-wing radicals. This is an assault fundamentally on the independence of the judiciary.
Senator Cruz outside the U.S. Supreme Court earlier today. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing that she is offering a concession in an effort to reach an agreement with Republicans that would allow the creation of a commission to investigate what happened on January 6th, the attack on the U.S. Capitol. Speaker Pelosi telling reporters at her weekly news conference that she's agreed to make the panel evenly split between Democrats and Republicans and to change the way subpoenas would be issued, requiring a joint decision by the chair and the vice chair or after a majority vote. More details from her news conference on Capitol Hill.
Madam Speaker, if we could get an update on the 1-6 Commission. We know that you've said that you're willing to equal number of Republicans and Democrats and equal subpoena power, but your Republican counterparts have said that they have not received your proposal yet. Have you extended that offer to them, and what other parts of the proposal do you hope to change? And what, just in general, what is the state of the negotiation?
Well, there are three things in terms of the legislation. The makeup of the commission, the process within the commission, and the scope of the commission. Two objections that the Republicans had was that they wanted to have it even instead of the president having an appointment, just have it the House, the Democrats and Republicans, and we yielded on that. I think the president should have it, but nonetheless, the scope is what is important. If that's where their discomfort is, we yield on that. The second part was on process, where they had a concern about the subpoena power. We have said that we would agree to the subpoena power that I think they would agree to, that is that the chair and the ranking, the chair and the vice chair would have to agree on a subpoena or a majority of the committee, of the commission agree. That seems to address the subpoena. We'll see. We still don't know where they will be on scope. But some of this is, interaction among members on committees, et cetera. And if we can come to agreement on the first two, why would they object to the scope, which is to find the truth of what happened on January 6th when an insurrection descended upon the Capitol. I don't need to describe it to you, but our purpose is to find the truth for that.
And that from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on the idea of a truth commission looking into what happened January 6th, bringing this response from House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy.
On the January 6th thing, let's say you did get a piece of paper and what she's laid out is she's going to give you equal representation, Republicans and Democrats. She's going to make subpoenas a joint decision between the chair and the vice chair, or a vote of the committee. So those.
Okay. I've only heard that in Punch News. I have not heard that. Did I plug you enough by saying that? That's pretty good.
For the purposes of this question, could you just give us a little bit of your thoughts about what that would mean?
In all due respect, I'm not going to negotiate through Punch News or others.
Punch Bowl News.
I'm sorry, I'm getting it wrong. I just became a subscriber last week. Give me a break.
I'm going to check on that.
Oh, have we finally?
I don't know yet.
Okay. Look, I was very clear with the speaker early on, so was Leader McConnell, and so were those who did the 9/11 commission. For any commission to work or for any ability, it has to be in a fair process, equal number of Republicans, subpoena, and a number of others. We said that was the minimum to sit down to negotiate. She hasn't even responded to us or talked to us, so it's still a long way away. I think if anything is going to have to happen, she's going to have to talk with us instead of saying she's talking to some Republicans. We don't even know if they're elected who she's talking to.
By the way, Punchbowl News is a news website that was recently formed by veterans of Politico. Also at today's news conference, the Republican leader was asked to respond to recent comments by former President George W. Bush. Out with a new book based on his paintings and the issue of immigration. The 43rd president, a Republican, saying the current state of the GOP is a party of isolationists, protectionists, and to a certain extent, nativists. Here is Republican leader Kevin McCarthy.
If I looked at the last election, the Republican Party in Congress, if you're looking at Congress, has elected more women than at any time in the history of the Republican Party. We broadened our party with the number of minorities as well. Every single Democrat that lost 15 lost to a Republican woman or a Republican minority. So the description that I've heard you say seems quite different than what reality is playing out today. I think my record stands for itself. I removed Steve King from committee. When I landed from a flight last week reading Punchbowl News, I put a tweet out right then. We will always condemn any language and any racism that we see in that process.
And that's from the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy of California. And now to a story first reported by Politico.com. A congressman who was on the baseball field during the 2017 shooting that nearly killed a fellow Republican colleague, GOP Whip Steve Scalise, saying that the FBI privately informed lawmakers that the gunman's plan was suicide by cop. Earlier today, reporter Kyle Chaney explained.
Sure. So this was kind of out of left field during a worldwide threats hearing with the House Intelligence Committee. Rep. Brad Wenstrup, who was one of the lawmakers on the baseball field in 2017 when a gunman started firing on all of them and struck Steve Scalise, the Republican majority whip at the time, and now the minority whip. He raised this with Director Ray. He said, your agents told me in 2017 that this was determined to be a suicide by cop. Now, that's new information, at least publicly. That was never publicly disclosed at the time. So 4 years later, we're learning that the FBI relayed this to lawmakers, and he's outraged because he says this is clearly a domestic terrorism attack. This is someone who went out to kill Republican lawmakers, and to call it a suicide by cop, he said it to minimize, and in his view, at least it's for political reasons. So he raised that again 4 years after the fact, but for the first time publicly.
And pushing back, in his words, as you point out in your story, it doesn't take 136 rounds. It takes just one bullet. Can you explain?
Right. He says, look, suicide by cop is a real phenomenon, but if you want to get killed by a cop, which again is a horrible thing, it doesn't require you to go out and try to attack and kill dozens of members of Congress. You know, that there's clearly more to it than just wanting to be killed by police. And so this is why he said, again, I don't know why he raised it at this moment so many years later, but something he clearly has been weighing on him since that time.
And again, to remind our listeners, this took place back in June of 2017 in Alexandria, Virginia, as Republicans were preparing for the annual congressional baseball game. Why has the FBI not before released this?
Good question. They were pretty tight-lipped with me when I asked about whether Wenstrup's account was correct. They wouldn't confirm that they even told him this to him. And truly, they had this note. There's nothing publicly documented about their investigation that discloses their conclusions about this. So Wenstrup's disclosure really was the first time there'd been any sort of update since the immediate days after the attack. It's just something that's been a mystery for this many years and never followed up upon.
The headline at Politico.com, lawmakers reveal and dispute the FBI conclusion on that 2017 baseball field shooting. The story that Kyle Chaney broke earlier today. We thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, on our podcast, The Weekly, we talked to USC professor April Thames. She offers her perspective on the death of George Floyd, this week's guilty verdict for that Minneapolis police officer, and the overall state of race relations in America. I asked her if we as a society are still paying a price for the stain of slavery in our history.
Oh, absolutely. We are still paying the price because when you really think about, I mean, there have been, I don't want to downplay the amount of change that has happened since the civil rights era, but I was just doing a talk today and I was looking through some of the old historical events such as the Little Rock Nine, you know, and watching those kids going to school and all the backlash that was occurring simply because these kids wanted an education and being denied that. And even though we've come a long way from, for example, that instance, we still see blacks in disproportionate numbers of high poverty schools and not receiving the type of education that they deserve. So yes, we have come away from not being able to get an education at all, but we also have to look at where we've become. So when you ask about slavery, the idea of slavery has to do with this person's inferior, therefore they work for me. They work for somebody who is more superior than them. And we see this all the time in the workforce when it comes to workplace discrimination, when it comes to inequitable health care. So yes, I think we're still paying the price.
Certainly a significant week for America. More of our conversation with April Thames on C-SPAN's The Weekly. She also shares her interesting biographical story that led to her research on race in America. The Weekly is available wherever you get your favorite podcast. And a reminder, this program is also a podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. I'm Steve Scully for the Thursday edition of Washington Today. Hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.